or a moth sat on a skull. And that so it rested, with no more concern than it would feel upon a stone. That a human being came suddenly upon the skull, and that, from him, a gush of mystic fright marked the moth. The death's head moth. On the back of the thorax of this insect is a representation of a human skull that is as faithful a likeness as ever any pirate drew. In Borneo and many other places, there is not much abhorrence for a human skull, but the death's head moth is a native of England. Or the death's heads that appeared upon window panes, at Bully, except that perhaps there were no such occurrences at Bully. Suppose most of what I call data may be yarns. But the numbers of them except, what does that mean? Oh, nothing, except that some of our opponents, if out in a storm long enough, might have it dawn on them that it was raining. If I could say of any pictorial representation that has appeared on the wall of a church that it was probably not an interpretation of chance arrangements of lights and shades, but was a transference from somebody's mind, then from a case like this, of the pretty, the artistic, or of what would be thought of by some persons as the spiritual, and a subject to be treated reverently, would flow into probability a flood of everything that is bizarre, malicious, depraved, and terrifying in witchcraft, and of course jostles of suggestions of uses. In this subject I have had much experience. Long ago, I experimented. I covered sheets of paper with scrawls, to see what I could visualize out of them, tacked a sheet of wrapping paper to a ceiling, and smudged it with a candle flame, made what I called a visualizing curtain, which was a white window shade, covered with scrawls and smudges, went on into three dimensions, with boards veneered with clay. It was long ago, about 1907. I visualized much, but the thought never occurred to me that I marked anything. It was my theory that, with a visualizing device, I could make imaginary characters perform for me more vividly than in my mind, and that I could write a novel about their doings. Out of this idea I developed nothing, anyway at the time. I have had much experience with visualizations that were, according to my beliefs, at the time, only my own imaginings, and I have had not one experience so recognized by me of ever having imaginatively marked anything. Not that I mean anything by anything. There is one of these appearances that many readers of this book may investigate. Upon February 23, 1932, New York newspapers reported a clearly discernible figure of Christ in the variegations of the sepia-toned marble of the sanctuary wall of St. Bartholomew's Church, Park Avenue and 50th Street, New York City. In the New York Times, February 24, 1932, the rector of the church, the Rev. Dr. Robert Norwood, is quoted. One day, at the conclusion of my talk, I happened to glance at the sanctuary wall and was amazed to see this lovely figure of Christ in the marble. I had never noticed it before. As it seemed to me to be an actual expression on the face of the marble of what I was preaching, his glorious body, I consider it a curious and beautiful happening. I have a weird theory that the force of thought, a dominant thought, may be strong enough to be somehow transferred to stone in its receptive state. In 1920, a censor stopped a show, but, in 1930, the Ladies' Home Journal published William Seabrook's story clipping sent to me by Mr. Charles McDaniel, East Liberty P.O., Pittsburgh, PA. There was a performance in the village of DOA, in the Benhounian territory of the French West African colony. It is a story of sorceries practiced by magicians, not upon their own bodies, but upon the bodies of others. There were the two living children close to me. I touched them with my hands. And there equally close were the two men with their swords. The swords were iron, three-dimensional, metal, cold and hard. And this is what I now saw with my eyes, but you will understand why I am reluctant to tell of it, and that I do not know what seeing means. Each man, holding his sword stiffly upward with his left hand, tossed a child high in the air with his right, then caught it full upon the point, impaling it like a butterfly on a pin. No blood flowed, but the two children were there, held aloft, pierced through and through, impaled upon the swords. The crowd screamed now, falling to its knees. Many veiled their eyes with their hands, and others fell prostrate. Through the crowd the jugglers marched, each bearing a child aloft, impaled upon his sword, and disappeared into the witch doctor's enclosure. Later Seabrook saw the children, and touched them, and had the impression that he would have, looking at a dynamo, or at a storm at sea, at something falling from a table, or at a baby crawling, that he was in the presence of the unknown. 27. The twitch of the legs of a frog, and Emma Piggott swiped a powder puff. The mysterious twitchings of electrified legs and unutterable flutterings in the mind of Galvani. His travail of mental miscarriages or ideas that could not be born properly. The twitch of trivialities that were faint and fantastic germinations in the mind of Galvani. The uninterpretable meanings of far distant hums of motors. These prenatal stirrings of aeroplanes and transportation systems and the lighting operations of cities. Twitch of the legs of a frog. A woman, from Brewster, N.Y., annoyed a hotel clerk. My general expression is that all human beings who can do anything, and dogs that track unseen quarry, and homing pigeons, and bird-charming snakes, and caterpillars who transform into butterflies, are magicians. In the lower, or quite as truly the higher, considering them the more aristocratic and established forms of being, the miracles are standardized and limited, but human affairs are still developing, and sports, as the biologists call them, are of far more frequent occurrence among humans. But their development depends very much upon a sense of sureness of reward for the pains, travail, and discouragements of the long, little paid period of apprenticeship, which makes questionable whether it is ever worthwhile to learn anything. Reward depends upon harmonization with the dominant spirit of an era. Considering modern data, it is likely that many of the fakirs of the past, who are now known as saints, did, or to some degree did, perform the miracles that have been attributed to them. Miracles, or stunts, that were in accord with the dominant power of the period were fostered, and miracles that conflicted with, or that did not contribute to, the glory of the church, were discouraged, or were savagely suppressed. There could be no development of mechanical, chemical, or electric miracles. And that, in the succeeding age of materialism, or call it the industrial era, there is the same state of subservience to a dominant, so that young men are trained to the glory of the job, and dream, and invent in fields that are likely to interest stockholders, and are schooled into thinking that all magics, except their own industrial magics, are fakes, superstitions, or newspaper yarns. I am of the industrial era, myself, and, even though I can see only advantages, disadvantages in all uses, I am very largely only a practical thinker. Or the trail of a working witchcraft, and we're on the scent of utilities. Or that, if a girl, in the town of Derby, set a house afire, by a process that is now somewhat understandable, a fireman could, if he had a still better understanding, have put out that fire without moving from his office. If the mechanism of a motor can invisibly be stopped, all the motors of the world may, without the dirt, crime, misery, and exploitation of coal mining, be started and operated. If Ambrose Small was wished so far away that he never got back, though that there is magic in a mere wish, or in a mere hope, or hate, I do not think the present snails of the wheels and planes may be replaced by instantaneous teleportations. If we can think that quacks and cranks and scientists of highest repute, who have announced successes, which were in opposition to supposed medical, physical, chemical, or biological principles which are now considered impostures, or errors, or premature announcements, may not in all cases have altogether deceived themselves, or tried to deceive others, we or maybe only I extend this suspicion into mechanical fields. Now it is my expression that all perpetual motion cranks may not have been dupes, or rascals, that they may have been right, occasionally that their wheels may sometimes have turned, their marbles rolled, their various gimcracks twirled, in an excess of reaction over action, either because sometimes will occur exceptions to any such supposed law as the conservation of energy, or because motivating rays emanated from the inventors. That sometimes engines have run, fueled with zeals, but have, by such incipient, or undeveloped, witchcraft, operated only transiently, or only momentarily, but that they may be forerunners to such a revolution of the affairs of this earth, as once upon a time were flutters of the little lids of tea kettles. A new era of new happiness and new hells to pay, ambitions somewhat realized, and hopes dashed to nothing, new crimes, pastimes, products, employments, unemployments, labor troubles, or strikes that would be worldwide, new delights, new diseases, disasters such as had never before been heard of. In this existence of the desirable undesirable. Wild carrots in a field and to me came a dissatisfaction with ham and cabbage. That was too bad, there isn't much that is better. My notion was that probably all around were roots and shoots and foliages that might be, but that never had been, developed eatably but that most unlikely would be the cultivation of something new to go with ham, in the place of cabbage, because of the conventionalized requirements of markets. But once upon a time there were wild cabbages and wild beets and wild onions, and they were poor, little incipiencies until they were called for by markets. I think so. I don't know. At any rate, this applies to wild fruits.